Today I'm going to talk to you about why you want a really strong guarantee called region serializability for all of your programs, especially those with data races. And hopefully the previous speaker has convinced you it's really hard to write correct multi-threaded programs. So here is one way of visualizing the space of guarantees we can provide for programs. So these are language level guarantees that I'm interested in. So what is the compiler, the runtime, and the hardware going to guarantee for you? So on one end of the spectrum, you have something that's really good for the underlying system. It's easy for it to optimize the program for performance. So the guarantee we currently have for C and C++ programs is called DRF0, or data race free zero. So this is good for optimizations because the system can have this really strong assumption that it doesn't have to worry about races in the program it's optimizing. Unfortunately, this means there are no guarantees for your program in the case that there is a data race. So this is probably not very desirable. So an alternate proposal that's been out there is called sequential consistency. And sequential consistency, this memory model guarantees that your program will behave as if there is a single global serial order of all instructions, and this respects the original program order of these instructions. Unfortunately, this is considered typically too expensive to provide multi-threaded programs. So what I'm going to propose today is on the far end of the spectrum, where there are fewer possible program behaviors, which makes the program much easier for the programmer and tools to reason about, and we're going to call this region serializability, RS. So it's stronger than sequential consistency because what I'm going to provide is that you only have to reason about interleavings of atomic regions, so things that are larger than individual instructions. So for this talk, I will be talking about C and C++ programs, so I'll go through a very simple example. So in this example, there are two threads, and there are two shared variables, A and B, and they're protected by locks capital A and capital B. This is a really simple program, so we can stare at it and convince ourselves it's race-free. That is, all of the accesses to A are protected, and the single access to B is protected by the correct lock. Because it's well-synchronized, it has this nice property that if you want to think about, well, what are the values possibly in A and B at the end of the program, you only have to think about the interleavings of these atomic regions of code. Specifically, you would only think about these two regions that I've shown and say there are two interleavings, so two possible results, which is great. This is probably what you wanted and why you inserted all these synchronization operations. Unfortunately, it's really easy for a programmer to forget to, say, acquire lock A. And all of a sudden, you can't reason about these regions atomically. So you might be saying, okay, there are only three instructions. I'll just interleave all of them manually and determine what the possible behaviors of your program are. I'll point out that this is going to get really hard, right? It'll grow exponentially as the number of instructions increases. But also, you're making this other underlying assumption when you're doing this sort of analysis. That is, your system provides sequential consistency, which, as I mentioned, it does not, because it's too expensive right now. So you can't even think about your program like that. So what's actually executing, you know, what is actually happening with your multi-threaded program, say, when I'm executing it on multiple cores? What you're interested in is probably that value of A that I've shown on CPU2. What is that read returning? And transitively, what are the values in all these other variables I've highlighted that the value of A propagates to? Now, you're making another assumption here that this is the actual code that the compiler has churned out, and this is the binary that's actually running on your two CPUs. And you can't actually make this assumption because we have data race free zero, which says your program has a race, I still haven't acquired lock A properly, no guarantees. So it'd be completely valid for your compiler to compile this program, and this is what's actually executing, and this is what you're trying to debug. So you have these out of thin air values that your compiler could produce, and all of a sudden, you really don't know what your program's going to do. And this is a horrible mess to try to debug and try to reason about, whether you're in development or production. And this seems to be, DRF0 has this fundamental belief that, well, your program is racy, you don't deserve any semantics. So we can ignore these programs, right? And, you know, this might be okay. You could ignore them, you can just declare them illegal, but there are real applications out there that you want to run, like Firefox, MySQL, OpenOffice, and Apache, and these all have data races in them. And some of these data races are bugs. You'll see them in bug reports, and people will go and fix them. Unfortunately, programmers write in data races intentionally. We can argue all day about whether this is misguided or not, but they're there. And so you'll have to eventually support this legacy code with data races in it. It could be for performance. The programmer might just think, I know what I'm doing. I understand what's going on. So this data race free zero model is just not going to work for us. We would actually like to provide something much stronger given the prevalence of data races in these programs. So what are we actually going to provide these programs? So let's go back to our original buggy source code. So I'm not going to say we should figure out what the programmer's intentions were and grab the locks for them, because that's really hard to do. But I'll point out you can see the existing locking structure that's in place. So the programmer did acquire some locks, and we can still detect regions between these existing synchronization operations. So what we're going to propose is region serializability, that there's a global atomic order for these regions that we can still detect in the code. So this is the guarantee we're going to propose, that there are atomic synchronization-free regions that I've already shown you, and that there's that your program executes as if there's a global serial order of these regions. So the benefits of this, well, obviously, this is exactly how we reasoned about the code when it was correctly synchronized. So this is very intuitive for programmers and tools to think about. The other thing is, because we're guaranteeing that these blocks of code execute atomically, we can still optimize within the individual region. So the compiler is still, yes?
So what about nested regions?
Pardon?
Nested regions, what happens
to them? So you mean regions that are far apart in time?
No, one region inside of another. Like grab block A, grab block B.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so grab block A, grab block B. So between those two lock acquisitions, that's an individual synchronization-free region. It's not from lock to release. It's between each individual synchronization operation that is the region.
So if I've got blocks, I can reduce the granularity of my synchronization?
Yes, you would be. And other synchronization operations that we consider other than locks are system calls and volatile memory accesses. So those would all reduce the size of your region.
Yes. That you want to detect the regions statically, but is that right?
Yes.
But that's often hard to do because often it's hard to pair a lock with the corresponding unlock statically.
Oh, we're not pairing the static or the acquisition and release of the synchronization operations. So when I showed you originally, like the acquisition of lock B and then the acquisition of lock A, the code between those two locking operations is in its individual region. So it is a static property. It's not a dynamic region based on lock and unlock. Yes?
So what if I have a function that calls a function, it calls a function, they all talk to each other, and eventually somebody makes a system call?
Mm-hmm.
Right, so now I have some sort of transaction boundary, at least dynamically.
Yes. So I guess you would, so that system call that you mentioned that's deeply nested, I guess, in a bunch of library calls would terminate the region, right? But it is a static property because if you trace through, like, okay, I'm going to call this function and then this next function. Mm-hmm. Well, then you would have to essentially do a worst case analysis, right? I may call or I may trigger this branch condition.
So that's what you're proposing.
Yes, that is what we're proposing. So in reality, your dynamic regions might be bigger, but when you think about it, it's a static property that you would look at the code and understand.
If I understand correctly, are you proposing to run transaction all the time? So this region seems like that transaction, right?
Yes, actually, our system really closely resembles transactional memory in the sense. So you're asking why we couldn't do this with just transactional memory?
No. So I'm saying you said that you would not want to use sequential consistent machine because it is too expensive, right? But these architectures seem to be more expensive than that because it is running transaction all the time.
So
he's basically saying hey, transactions are costly, and you said sequential consistency is costly.
Yes.
So why
okay, I will get to that. So this is one of the reasons this might be better than transactional memory is because it's well understood how these locking programs work, right? We don't have a good sense of how transactional programs will be written, but a lot of programs out there already use all these pthread locks, right? So the existing runtime systems already support that pretty efficiently. All right. Are there any other questions, or should I go on?
Go on.
Okay. All right, so back to your question about how are we going to do this? I've already told you sequential consistency is expensive, right? How am I going to give you something stronger than sequential consistency? So there are two components to how to provide region serializability. The first begins at the compiler. So the compiler must be involved in this, otherwise you're getting a guarantee with respect to the binary and not the actual source code. So what the compiler has to do is preserve these atomic regions from the source code. So the way we do this is we instrument the LLVM compiler and explicitly insert memory barriers around synchronization operations to prevent code motion between regions. The second component is the runtime. So what the runtime must do is it can only run one thread at a time because we don't know a priori whether or not there are any data races. So we have to serialize them on a single CPU. I see you guys making faces. I know the performance on that's going to be horrible. I will have a trick for that. And the other property for atomicity is it can only preempt at synchronization boundaries. Okay, so how is this going to work? So let's go back to our example, and we'll look at it running on an actual machine. So the first property that I don't move code outside of the synchronization-free region is satisfied. I haven't hoisted anything outside of these lock-unlock operations. The second property that I run one thread at a time is also satisfied, and that's useful because now we've serialized that access to A. We know what value is in A here, whereas if we'd run that second thread on another core, we don't actually know. We'd be at the mercy of the underlying hardware and what that provided. And I've only preempted after a synchronization operation. So I've satisfied all these three things. This will provide RS. Obviously, it's really slow. I've shown all of these spare cores. You've written a multi-threaded program. This is probably not what you want. I have a bunch of idle cores. But if you remember, I showed you another way of executing this program, right, where I said we don't really know what the values and all of these highlighted red variables are. But the nice thing about this is fast, right? And I get to use the cores and scale with increasing number of CPUs. We don't know what the values in A and B are, which is not good. But we have spare CPUs that we can run a second copy of the program on. And if you observe, if there weren't a data race, and I followed the happens before order of the faster execution, this would be sufficient to make sure that both of these executions would have the same result after they were finished. So I'm going to call these executions epochs, so these time intervals within your program. And they're both zero because they would be equivalent in the absence of a data race. And I'm going to go through how we're going to combine these two executions in order to allow your program to continue scaling while still providing the strong property. For terminology, the faster execution is going to be called the thread parallel execution because the threads are allowed to run in parallel on multiple CPUs. And the slower execution that actually provides us the strong guarantee, we're going to call the epoch parallel execution for reasons that are going to become apparent in the next slide. So the technique we're going to use is called uniparallel execution. This was first used in a deterministic record and replay system called double play. And what we do is we're going to run two copies of the program, the fast one and the slow one, as I suggested, or as I showed you earlier. And what we're going to do is we're going to run them in parallel, and we'll notice that the green execution, the thread parallel, finishes early. So we're going to take a speculative checkpoint of that state once we have it in advance, and use it to essentially hoist and start epoch one of the slower execution in parallel on your spare cores. And we're going to continue doing this and build a pipeline of these sequential executions in orange, and you'll notice it'll finish much faster than the light boxes I've shown if we just run them on a single CPU. Because we don't know whether or not there was a data race, this pipeline could be invalid. So we have to explicitly check the memory states after each epoch. So let's say we checked epoch 0 and 1, and the states match. So the memory pages are all the same, the machine registers are all the same. So let's say we check the end of epoch 2, and the states aren't the same. So what we're going to have to do is, because epoch 3 was started on the speculative state, we're going to have to roll back that epoch and re-execute from valid state. And observe, this only happens if there was an actual data race. You would need to do this and essentially flush your pipeline. All right, so the obvious cost of this technique is that we're going to double your oh, wow, that's really bad. Okay. So there was a graph here. So it would show that we're at least doubling the utilization. Do you guys want to see the graph? I can just grab my laptop. Okay, so it would double the utilization. So we use six different benchmarks. So two parallel desktop applications, PFScan and PBZip2. We tested also on Apache, and then three of the Splash benchmarks. Our testing machine had 8 cores, so we allowed every application to scale up to 8 threads so that it could fully utilize the cores. Then we took half of them away, essentially, to run our system. And so the mean overhead of that is 121%. You would expect 100% because we're having the core utilization. The 21% is the additional stuff to make uniparallel execution work. The compiler modifications add negligible overhead because right now LLVM is unable to do that code motion anyways in order to optimize your program. The outlier that you would have seen in this graph was Apache because it's not network or it's not CPU bound, it's a network bound application. So it looks much better than 100% because it couldn't actually utilize all of those CPUs to do work anyways. But what I want to, okay, still no graph. What I want to tell you is that most of the work that we're introducing with uniparallel execution is highly parallelizable. So when you do have spare CPUs on your system, which we expect you will, because a lot of applications can't scale all the way, and the more and more CPUs are becoming available, the program performance looks much better. So specifically, if you have one thread, you're looking at a 4% overhead, two threads, 8%. Three threads, 11%, and four threads would be a 27% runtime overhead from uniparallel execution. So what have I talked to you about today? So I've really gone over two big things. One is a way to give RS to all programs, especially those with data races. But really what I've argued for is that we need strong guarantees for all of your programs. That DRF0 is not sufficient. And the correct guarantee that we should be providing people is called region serializability. All right, I'll take any questions. Yes?
You said you can only schedule on those boundaries, right? What if you run a tight loop for nothing, for semicolon, semicolon, another semicolon runs? So you can never preempt this code, could you?
If I had an infinite loop, or? Right, then you would have the issue, you would have to essentially give up liveness for safety, right? Because we don't have a preemption, a point that we can use.
Okay, so if we had one thread that does not use logs,
mm-hmm.
then this thread would always run. Could never be preempted ever from CPU.
If it were scheduled, it's highly unlikely though, if you have a multi-threaded application, that there would be a single thread to exhibit this behavior. And other things are like volatile memory accesses will happen, right? System calls. So I guess the thread that never does any of this is a pathological case. Yes? Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. So I think this is a really interesting idea to combine uniparallels and single-dimensional data regions. I was wondering, I think I need to read your paper and think about it more, but I'm trying to figure out what the difference is in the memory semantics provided by this versus something like conflict exceptions or DRFX, because it seems like the major difference is not the synchronization degrees, but rather the combination of those things with uniparallel execution. So I was wondering if you could say something about that.
So one of the major differences is the way we've proposed doing it is a software-only system, and so we don't really rely on any of the hardware modifications the other works rely on. So this would work right now. I would be really hesitant to give you something right now. I'd like to talk offline. Thanks. Of course.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, I don't see why this approach wouldn't work for these systems, right? Because they're written in C and C++, and they use pthread synchronization just like these other applications. Mostly it's program complexity and getting it to work on a prototype research system. There has been a question in the back. Oh.
One more question while the third person is setting up.
Oh, go ahead. I think you've had your arm up for a while. I'm not introducing any new potential interleavings, right? I'd only be restricting the possible interleavings. The locked regions that would have been atomic with respect to one another before would still be atomic.
What is that true?
We would still respect the original synchronization of the program.
Okay, so let's go ahead and take the other questions offline. Let's thank Jessica again.